You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 368 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Superman Lost number 10, Jay Garrick the Flash number 4, Batman Superman World's Finest number 23, Action Comics 1061, Green Lantern number 7, Titans Beast World number 4, and Sweet Tooth season 2 episode 7, I'll Find You. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC News. Damian Wayne takes the spotlight in The Boy Wonder, a new DC Black Label series that is described as an accessible and heart-trending fairy tale. Written and drawn by Junie Baugh, the five-issue series explores Batman's son, sometimes difficult relationship with the other men who have been Robin. Nightwing, Red Hood, and Red Robin. In the series, which launches in May, Batman has been called away on urgent business. When rumors start spreading of a demon stalking the streets of Gotham, Damian must work together with the other Robins to save the day.
I'm excited for a Black Label Robin book, Drew. I think that could be pretty good. I'm also excited for it to not be Williamson writing Damian for a little bit. So it's a 2-for-1 win for me.
Yeah, I'm excited about it too. Though, I looked at some of the artwork. I didn't care for it that much. So, I don't know if you got a chance to see the artwork or not.
It looked very stylized. I'll have to wait and see it, you know, in action, so to speak, in the comic to really... Yeah, but I agree. It wouldn't be my first pick, but I'm reserving judgment until I get the full comic.
I understand that. I like the idea of this story. So, even if I think the artwork looks a little wonky, I'm still excited about it, as long as it's well written. All right, well, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. A new look at Joker 2 is here, and it shows Lady Gaga's Harley Quinn in mad love with Joaquin Phoenix's Joker. The fresh batch of photos were shared by the film director Todd Phillips to celebrate Valentine's Day. In the pictures, Gaga's Harley looks head over heels for Joker, with the duo dancing on a rooftop and even rubbing noses through prison bars. Excitedly, Phillips also replied to a question about when the first trailer would be coming. The movie comes out in October, he wrote, so our first teaser won't be out until mid-April. That means we can expect footage from the movie in about 2 months.
Yeah, I don't expect footage anytime soon, Drew, and I don't think there needs to be. I mean, I think that the movie was a big enough success that it ideally doesn't need a really heavy-handed push in the marketing department. Again, I'm not saying that they shouldn't market the film, but that it doesn't need, you know, the kind of extra push that something like Blue Beetle would. I'm very curious to see if they can replicate the success of the first one, Drew. I just don't know. I mean, the first one proved me wrong. The whole time before it came out, Drew, I just was so sure it was going to be bad. And then it was one of the better films that DC has put out in the last decade, to be honest. It was good, like shockingly good. And I am curious to see if the second one can match that, or if they try and basically do the first one again to diminishing returns. Very curious to find out.
Yeah, I am too. I'm curious to see what it's going to look like. So that's coming out later this year, so I guess we'll be finding out, huh?
Yeah.
All right, and for our last bit of DC news, speaking at CW's TCA panel, network boss Brad Schwartz revealed that the fourth and final season of Superman and Lois has been pushed back to the fall. Speaking with reporters in Los Angeles, Schwartz said that he thought the show would have been wasted over the summer, and that it's good enough to compete with the fall lineup from other networks. I read that and I'm like, really? Because I just thought it was kind of funny that he wanted to push it back to the fall lineup, because the last several years that I know of, I haven't really paid attention to any fall lineup.
Yeah,
I mean everything I watch
that you have made like 15, 20 years ago. But I agree completely with you, Drew. Nobody's paying attention to when shows actually come out. How many people are watching this much a lot live? I know some are. I'm not saying it's zero, but I agree completely with you, Drew. That's a I don't get that at all. Like that, it's one of two things, and I think they are equally likely. It is an executive who is out of touch with how people are really watching shows. I think that's very possible, very plausible. Or they're just making something up because the show's not ready to be out yet, and they need to push it, and they want to spin it in a positive way. And maybe it's even a mix of both.
That could very well be. But I've read that article. I'm like, who's watching all the shows in the fall? I pick up series all the time streaming. So it's just, that's how people watch TV now, is they just pick things out and watch it. You're not tuning in Thursday night at 8 p.m. anymore to watch a show.
No.
That's very old school. I remember making sure I was in front of TV like on a Thursday night to watch The Flash or something. Yeah, that's old school TV. Everything's streaming now. You just get on there and you pick what you want to watch and you watch it. Sometimes you watch several episodes in a row. Sometimes you All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different with the ESO Network Patreon. The cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at Patreon.com/ESO Network.
Attention, people of Earth! Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast. It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us! Bring coffee!
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at Flopcast.com. Dot net.
And we're back, but before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers. For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Superman Lost number 10. Lois uncovers the truth about Senator Mick Monagle's affair. She keeps it out of the news, but helps clear his name of the bribery charge. Victor's Planet, Year 22. Superman has failed. The sun is a red giant approaching supernova. Even if Superman could find his way back there, he would be powerless. Hope has arrived on Earth and to Superman's apartment. She is clearly pregnant and Lois does not look happy. Hope informs Superman that before his ship was destroyed, it returned telemetry of his journey from Victor's planet to Earth. Hope has come to bring back help and her ring has mapped out the journey. When trouble breaks out in Cosnia, Superman flies there and intervenes. Superman tells them, "Not even I can stop all your wars. But I can stop this one, at least for today. What you choose to make of this day is up to you." Superman visits Lex, who calls Superman the Un-Messiah. He can stop all wars, end poverty, and hunger, but chooses not to. Superman states that Lois beat him. Lex should take comfort in Superman's struggle because he wouldn't like the alternative. The Justice League has gathered in Clark's apartment. Hope thanks Clark for giving her a home, for teaching her honor, faith, and someday she will be worthy of him. Hope kisses Clark on the cheek, and then the Justice League teleport away. Lois asks if Hope's baby is Clark's. Clark states that Hope's species reproduces through parthenogenesis. Lois states that she knows that Hope found a live follicle in his hairbrush. She basically cloned him. Lois tells Clark to go with his super friends and save Victor's planet. Lois is tired of living with a ghost and wants her husband back. Clark returns home and finds Lois asleep at her laptop. Clark apologizes, stating he didn't realize he'd be gone for a couple days. Lois asks him where his white suit is and about Victor, but Clark doesn't know what she's talking about. Clark tells Lois that the alien shot him out of the airlock here at Earth. Anomaly 8612. Timeline uncertain. Victor's planet has been saved. Superman drops out of hyperspace as the rest of the Justice League heads home. Superman reunites with the old Superman floating in space. Superman programs the alien ship to drop Superman off at Earth instead of taking him to Victor's planet. Finally, something got lost in translation as Hope's baby was actually Shimmy's. The hair follicle that Hope found was his. He became the first Arcadian born as a citizen of the Republic.
What the hell, Drew? What the hell? What are we even doing? What are we... I don't understand, man. I feel like I had this reaction a lot with whatever, like, how Priest chooses to wrap up his stories. I feel like individual issues of his, Drew, really aren't bad. But then when he tries to wrap up an arc, it's just like he just sort of throws his hands up in the air and is like, ah, whatever. Here you go. This is, what, the second or third book in a row of his where I've just been like, what? How is this how we're ending this book? Drew, there was so much that happened in this issue. You're telling me we couldn't have covered some of this a little bit quicker in some of the previous issues?
But we wouldn't have had the big mystery.
What even was the mystery ultimately, though? Oh my God, what the hell? It's not even fully clear to me how exactly Superman got back beyond time travel shenanigans. I'm not convinced that if I had Priest sit down and explain it to me, that he could explain it to me in detail beyond time travel shenanigans.
It had to be time travel shenanigans, because otherwise he wouldn't be able to send Clark back a few days later.
Oh, I know. No, I know it. I know it's time travel, but like, you could give a more specific, like, which version of Superman that is. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I vaguely get it, but I don't feel like he bothered to explain it that much, and I'm not convinced that he cares that much beyond just, time travel. That's not good enough, Drew. You can't have everything, essentially the crux of the story, right? The payoff, ultimately, of the story is that the real, quote, unchanged Superman comes back at the end, and none of the story means anything, except Lois has lifetime trauma to deal with now.
That's pretty much what it is, because he sent the Superman back that basically was picked up by that alien ship. So when Clark went through the black hole or whatever the heck it was, of course, number one, that never made any sense to me. But anyways, when he went through that black hole thing and ended up in space, when he got picked up by the aliens, instead of being dropped off at Victor's planet, he was actually dropped off on Earth because one of the Supermen in the future programmed that ship to take him there. So that's why that Superman had, when that Superman came back, he didn't know what Lois was talking about, because he never went through any of that stuff. But that doesn't explain how that loop keeps working in the future. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yes. Oh, exactly. Like, I agree, Drew. I'm on the same page as you. I understand basically what happens, but the process of it doesn't, like you said, how is that loop working? What exactly is the loop? That was not clear to me, other than, again, it was just sort of hand-waved as time travel. But then left, I thought, unexplained. Priest's explanation was essentially that Lois will just accept it and move on. What? Drew, what? What version of Lois Lane would just accept that she got a different version of Superman and just be content and not question it further?
Exactly. She'd question everything.
And who is still very much under the impression that Superman unintentionally had a kid with someone else. That she doesn't get the answer to that.
No, she doesn't, does she? So
and then my other huge question, Drew, is so Superman sets up this loop for reasons that are a little bit unclear, because he doesn't seem to think that he'd actually be able to come back, right? The rest of the Justice League? Did they just all leave and die? Is that just the end of the Justice League, Drew? What about them?
No, as far as we know, the Justice League made it back, and if Superman wouldn't have stopped, he would have made it back too. See? It doesn't make sense.
But no, but like, they don't even, because he said that the whole thing to get them off the planet, because it had gone into a red giant, it took them, what, 10 years is what he said? Or like a long time. The Justice League was just pieced out for 10 years, Drew? That doesn't make sense. That is completely unexplained.
They have a Green Lantern with them. They'd be able to get back a lot faster than that. I'm sorry.
But the process, he according to Clark, the process once they actually got there was not a quick one-day job. That's what I'm saying. So they just showed up and helped for a little bit and then left because the timer was up? Like, what? I know you don't have... I'm not expecting you to come up with the answers for this, Drew. I'm just... This is... What are we doing? How is this how we're ending this book?
Let's just end it and move on, Cliff. Yeah. We're never going to get any answers out of this thing. The other thing is, how could the Hope's baby thing, how did it go from being Clark's to Shemmy's?
I think the book wanted to absolve him from being, even though he wouldn't have been responsible, I think they wanted him to not be responsible.
I know, that was also a weird transition.
I also think that Priest really believed that somehow forgave or undid the sin of the Green Lantern, right? That she murdered him, but then she cloned him and birthed him again. And now it's okay. Like, is it okay?
No, it's not okay.
That was the thing. Like, it was like sort of my big problem with the ending is that ultimately everything essentially resets back to the way it was, and almost nothing, no permanent consequence happens. Except that's not, you know what I mean? Except it's not really like, it's a very imperfect resetting. Like, the edges don't line up quite the right way, but Priest basically is like slapping his hands like, all right, we're done here, boys.
Superman wouldn't let that death go either. You know what I mean?
I know. I just don't, I really, really did not enjoy this issue. The very unsatisfying ending to this story.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Jay Garrick, The Flash, number 4. The Flash, Jay Garrick, and his daughter, The Boom, traveled to the main Star Labs building in Detroit. Mr. Terrific and the boys were able to pinpoint Dr. Hugh's last place of employment here. The speedsters are surprised to learn that Mr. Slate is already expecting them. Mr. Slate explains that Dr. Hughes is the reason Star Lab exists. He showed up on Mr. Slate's doorstep with money and a plan. Mr. Slate only had to make him a silent partner and let him do his experiments in private. Mr. Slate didn't realize he had made a deal with the devil himself. Mr. Slate hands the Flash Dr. Hughes' diary, which begins in Keystone 1938. The diary explains that when Green Lantern appeared, Dr. Hughes was determined to make a hero of his own. He went to Midwestern University and handpicked Jay Garrick. Dr. Hughes and Jay Garrick worked the next 3 years together. It was Jay Garrick's idea to use hard water as a catalyst for transformation. Dr. Hughes leaves Jay alone in the lab to separate the elements from the hard water. When Jay has completed the task, Dr. Hughes presses a button that causes a lab accident, making Jay a human test subject. Dr. Hughes leaves Jay lying unconscious in the chemicals for 3 hours before pretending to come upon him. Dr. Hughes takes a sample of blood before waking Jay up and having him rushed to the hospital. 3 days later, Jay has made a full recovery in the hospital. When the medical doctor learns of Jay Garrick's abilities, Dr. Hughes shoots him in the head. Dr. Hughes wants to keep the formula secret until it is tested and perfected. Jay Garrick becomes the Flash, while Dr. Hughes tries to replicate the test, and each time it fails. When Jay was becoming a hero, Dr. Hughes was becoming the devil. Dr. Hughes was funded by foreign factions and was able to control the elements themselves. The Justice Society eventually tracked down Dr. Hughes, now known as Dr. Elemental. The Boom travels back in time to join her father, and Dr. Elemental learns of her existence and gets a blood sample before escaping. Dr. Elemental retreats to a hidden secondary lab that even his former benefactors know nothing about. He continued his experiments there, all ending in failures. Garrick Laboratories, 1962. When a 5-alarm fire threatens to rage out of control, the Flash responds, leaving his daughter alone in the lab. Dr. Elemental strikes, duplicating the lab accident that turned Jay into the Flash. When the Flash returns to his lab, Judy has powers. Keystone City, 1963. Dr. Elemental kidnaps Joan Garrick and tries to experiment on Jay's wife. The Boom stops him, but then disappears before his eyes. The Garricks forget who Judy is. Deciding to conduct more experiments and do more studies, Dr. Hughes creates Star Labs and used it as a front. In the present, Mr. Slate's secretary comes in and states that Professor Hughes called. He says, "You are fired." The secretary's arm turns into a gun and she begins to open fire on Mr. Slate and the speedsters. Next issue, the Doctor is in for Joel Cyclone.
This is a very interesting retcon of this character, Drew. I don't really mind it necessarily because I would challenge how many people actually definitively know who Professor Hughes is. So it's definitely, when it's that old of a character and has frankly not really been involved much in comics, if at all, it's an easy character to really kind of have room to mess around and play with. But this is a drastic change to the character. On par, I would say, with Maxwell Lord's reinvention from being kind of like the, you know, unserious manager of the JLI to being the one of the most sociopathic masterminds in the DC villain catalog. This is up there, Drew. This is a very similar reinvention. It's interesting. My only kind of question, it's not a complaint, but really more of a question, is it was obviously very clear that he had an obsession with sort of like granting godhood to the two people, but to what end exactly, Drew? I didn't totally see how that served him. It seemed like he wanted the power himself, but like he seemed very content to be able to create it in other people and not that bothered by not having it himself. That was where it was a little, his motivation was slightly gray to me.
I know what you mean. And they don't really explain how he got his elemental powers either, because...
Oh, that was I was not satisfied with that explanation at all. They were like, due to the polarity... It was the vibrational, unique vibrations of the Earth, I could master the elements. I was like, what? That is the most mumbo-jumbo explanation you could... Like, why... if that's the explanation you're going to give me, don't even bother.
And what I didn't get was... He got those elemental powers. Why did he want to keep pursuing the speed powers when he could, if he got elemental powers for himself, why couldn't he give those to other people?
Yeah. That was my only real, I didn't totally understand his obsession with creating speedsters other than he seemed to enjoy, in a sense, like, I'm sure it somehow made him feel, like, if you can create a god, what does that make you? So I sort of think that's where they were trying to go, but I would have liked that spelled out a little more. You know, like, it was, I sort of get it, like, I'm mostly there, Drew, but it was just a little nebulous, and it felt like it feels so core to his character. I felt like I needed to understand it a little bit better, because the man is literally dedicating his life to this cause, and I don't fully grasp his motivation for doing so. He is so fanatical. When you make a character that fanatical, I feel like their motivations need to be crystal clear for the reader to fully get behind what they're doing.
Now, you talked about the retcon of this character. I don't know this character, so what changes were made?
Well, he is. So the origin obviously changed to view Professor Hughes in a more mastermind evil light, right? But the origin that they give is relatively what Jake Garrick's origin is. He's working in a lab with Professor Hughes on hard water, and somehow the accident that happens with that makes him the Flash, because that's what hard water does, Drew. It's one of those like great, silly kind of golden age, like, hey, there's this newfangled science thing we're working on. It made him a superhero this time. So they didn't really change the origin there too much. What they changed essentially is giving you from the perspective of Professor Hughes, who was a little bit like Dr. Erskine for Captain America in a lot of ways, except less intentional, obviously, in the original comic.
Oh, okay.
Much less intentional.
All right. Anything else you want to say about this issue?
Drew, I noticed, at least from what I saw on the cover, this one, they still haven't labeled it directly as a miniseries. And I don't believe them, one. And two, I remain very curious how this can have legs. Because I to be very clear, I am interested in this story. They've got me on this story, but I still don't know what does the third arc of this book look like? It feels like it's very dependent on the current arc.
I agree with you. I've been wondering if this has been a miniseries also, just like we found out about the Alan Scott Green Lantern title.
I'm still expecting the next issue to come out, so all of a sudden it's going to magically have a, you know, 4 or 5, whatever, out of 5. That's what I'm anticipating, but technically it's not yet been labeled as such, so we'll see.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman Superman World's Finest number 23. Gog Saharan Citadel, Earth 22. Gog tells Magog to gather their flock. The time has come to rise. Gog's plan is to lead the heroes in battle against Apocalypse and Darkseid. Gog believes he needs to die nobly in battle to gain passage to Valhalla, into heaven. Batman and Superman from both worlds show up at Gog's Citadel. Both Batman grab Magog while Superman fights Gog. Superman tells Gog that their fate is not for him to decide. Gog disagrees, stating he's bested Superman in combat and his will be the first death. You're welcome. Magog attacks Gog along with the other heroes who are not happy with Gog's plan. Batman was able to get through to David and break him of Gog's influence. Gog opens a boom tube to Apocalypse. When Gog is distracted, Batman helps Superman to his feet. Batman tells Superman that Gog's ability to overpower free will, it's the anti-life equation. Finding it, then using it to dominate the stars has always been Darkseid's goal. Both Supermen, with the help of David, take down Gog. They go to shut down the boom tube, but it's too late. Darkseid has arrived. To be concluded.
Drew, I'm totally on board with Gog's motivations and with what he's doing. I liked the Superman finally reaching now Magog, kind of redeeming the character again. The only thing I didn't love, Drew, is the lack of recognition that this would be the second Magog on this planet. There seemed to be no acknowledgement of that. It didn't seem to mean anything to the Kingdom Come Batman and Superman, and they had questions in regards to that.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think what intrigued me the most was the fact that we had the anti-life equation and Darkseid's there. I'm eager to see how this plays out.
I think it's a great spin on the revelation of like, hey, wait a second, if he's able to do this, what does that sound like? And then realize, what I loved is that Wade then goes, okay, wait a second, if someone found this, what would the real implications of this be? Not only would that person be a threat, the real threat would be Darkseid finding out and coming to get it, because he is singularly minded, obsessed with getting that, right? So I thought that was a good little bit of writing. I wouldn't necessarily to say I'm excited to see what happens next year, because I kind of feel like we know what's going to happen next issue. I would very much like to be surprised. I'll put it that way. I would be grateful to Wade if he pulled some sort of surprise next issue.
Let's hope that he does. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Action Comics 1061. The Planet Xerox, also known as the Sorcerer's World. Three sorcerers ponder the arrival of Bizarro to their world. Before the monster can wreak more havoc on this world, the three sorcerers unleash their combined magic onto Bizarro, trying to obliterate him. Bizarro laughs, absorbing the magic. Bizarro retaliates, using the magic he was just given to kill the sorcerers. 6 weeks later, Bizarro appears on Earth Zero. Superman tries to reason with him, but Bizarro smacks Superman to Venus's surface, 25 million miles. Superman has never seen that kind of power from Bizarro before. Bizarro appears on Venus and grabs Superman. He flies him past the corona of the sun, the moons of Jupiter, Saturn's ring, and smashes him into the surface of Pluto. Using his freeze vision, Bizarro encases Superman in ice. Superman uses his heat vision to break free, but Bizarro is gone. When Superman returns to Earth, he finds Bizarro and engages him in battle. An action news helicopter is broadcasting it across the city. The patrons of Bibbo's Bar place bets on who will win. Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane watch with binoculars from the top of the Daily Planet. As they battle, Bizarro explains to Superman that Bizarro World, Earth 29, is gone from the multiverse. The action news copter is in peril, and Superman saves it from destruction. When Superman returns to Bizarro, he has cast a spell, a magical vortex. Superman tries to pull Bizarro out of the vortex and fails. Bizarro is gone. Superman lands on top of the Daily Planet and watches the sky. Lois joins him, and Superman states he can still hear Bizarro weeping as if he's inside his head. Suddenly, Lois and the rest of Metropolis turn into Bizarros. Superman starts laughing uncontrollably. Next issue, City of Bizarro.
I really liked this. This was a great opening issue to really kick things off with a bang, Drew. I thought he did a great job establishing the premise of the story, along with enough action and a great cliffhanger to really, like, set up the story and make you go, okay. Like, you took notice. And I really want to see where this story goes. It was a great, great first issue to an arc. I'm a sucker for Bizarro. I like Bizarro stories quite a bit, especially when he's actually Bizarro, Superman Lois. This was great, Drew, and I loved the idea. Two things. I loved the idea of him using magic because he realizes that Superman is weak to it, and also because Superman is weak to it, it makes sense for Bizarro to be a master of magic, right? I don't know, Drew, that we've really seen that take on that before. I think we've seen that he doesn't have the same weaknesses because he's Bizarro, but I loved that spin on it, that like if Superman is weak to magic, not only would Bizarro be necessarily resistant to it, that in fact he should have some proficiency, right? I liked that spin on the character a lot. That was a really cool kind of viewpoint to take, and really kind of made the issue feel even more unique and going in a new direction. A great premise, Drew. I can't wait to see what's going to happen now. I can't wait. This is great. And what I love too is that Bizarro is a threat in the story, but he still feels like Bizarro. I don't feel like we're like going over the top and changing fundamentally who the character was. He still retained a little bit of that sympathy, right? Like the whole reason he's doing this is because he's lashing out because in an indirect way, Superman is responsible for Bizarro losing his world. And this is how Bizarro is reacting to that. Great, great writing. I thought the artwork went really well with the story. I'm very excited, Drew. This was a great, great first issue.
I loved it as well. I thought it was awesome. And one of the reasons I loved the story so much was we're seeing Bizarro do something different than what he's done before in the past. I really like the use of magic in this, and I love the artwork. I love where the story's going. It's different from other Bizarro stories I've read before, so I was happy about that. I was hoping we wouldn't get the same old, same old. I also thought it was odd that we still keeping Bibbo around. I guess everybody, I don't know if this is a mandate from DC that we got to have Bibbo in the Superman stories again. Feels like we're going back to the 90s. But yeah, I really enjoyed this first issue, and I'm looking forward to see what happens next. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Green Lantern number 7. Oa, some time ago, the Green Lantern Corps has assembled in the Great Hall to hear from the new bosses, the United Planets. Lord Premier Theros addresses the Lanterns, informing them that Sector 2814 has been quarantined until further notice because of yet another crisis emanating from that sector. The Lanterns of Sector 2814 are reassigned. Guy Gardner is tasked with apprehending the bounty hunter known as Lobo. Lanterns Hal Jordan and Kilowog are assigned to accompany Lord Premier Theros to Korugar. On Korugar, Lord Premier Theros meets with Supreme Leader Sinestro to talk about Korugar joining the United Planets. Hal gets into an argument with Sinestro and is ordered back to the ship by Lord Premier Theros. As Jordan leaves, Lord Premier Theros is attacked by three Yellow Lanterns. Kilowog protects the Lord Premier by taking on the three Yellow Lanterns by himself. Hal calls for backup and gets the Lord Premier safely back to his ship. When Kilowog is fighting the Yellow Lanterns, the Yellow Power Battery flares, incinerating the three Lanterns as well as Kilowog. Sinestro ends up signing the treaty, swearing he had nothing to do with the attack. Earth now. Razor informs Hal that the power battery on Odom has been destroyed. Next issue, warrant for arrest. We also had a backup story in this, Wayward Son Part 4. Korg is revealed to be skimming creds that should have been added to the home pot. Korg offers proof that Nagaf is really the selfish one and shows him doing even worse deeds. Everyone turns against Nagaf and makes Korg their leader. To be continued in Sinister Sons Number 1. Bet you're just clamoring for that Sinister Sons number one issue, aren't you?
Drew, Sin Son, come on. Are we even trying? Are we just giving up on giving characters names?
I guess so.
Sin Son is the best you can come up with? Dr. Hate? Like, what are we doing? What are we doing?
We're going back to the Golden Age, buddy.
Put some effort into it. My God. Drew, I don't dislike the... I don't think it belongs with the backup story is just so different artistically, tonally, from what the main book is doing. It just, it's not, it doesn't feel like it belongs. As its own story, it could be interesting. I mean, pairing up Zod's son with Sinestro's son is odd, but it could work. It could be a fun, like, evil super sons kind of book with Samazi on it. I think there's potential for that to work. Literally naming him anything other than Sin Son would be phenomenal. Literally anything. Name him Pink Guy. I would genuinely take that.
I didn't mind the name Korg. They should have stuck with that.
That was fine. There was nothing wrong with that. It was an alien name. Again, I don't necessarily think that the backup is bad, Drew. It totally doesn't feel like it belongs to me. It felt like it was attached only because it was tangentially related to Green Lantern. So they're like, I don't know where else to put this. So it's Green Lantern's backup. That was my main complaint with it.
They were probably trying to, get Green Lantern readers interested in it also.
Right, and I get that. I don't blame... Again, where else, what other book are you going to pair this with? There's no other book that it makes sense to get paired with. So I get it. It was just so disconnected in every way from the main story. That was my main problem with it. Now, that's not to say that can't be the case. Old school, if we want to go back to the Golden Age, like, that's just how comics were, right? You just had an amalgamation of stories and they were all packed into one big issue. But that's just not how it's been done recently. So... again, that's a personal quibble. It's fine. The real problem, Drew, is that the main book is so good that when you get to the backup, like, I don't know how you follow it up is the real problem. And that was no exception with this one. The main book was so good, Drew. Oh, my God. I felt like I was back in the Geoff Johns heyday of Green Lantern. You had Sinestro, thank God, wearing his yellow suit. In full dictator mode over Korgar, that and like Green Lantern's going in as like it felt a little almost Star Wars esque, Drew, where they were like the Jedi coming in and involved in politics that they don't really want to be a part of. Oh, Drew, so good. I can't express how much I'm enjoying this Green Lantern book.
Yeah, I read this a few days ago, and I'm like, I so wanted to text you about it. I'm like, no, we gotta save it for the podcast. But it was so good. I love this issue. We've got to finally find out what happened to Kilowog. Now, I'm not convinced that he's been incinerated. Honestly.
Agreed.
So I wouldn't be surprised if they got transported somewhere else or anything. But this was so good. I loved it. I loved finding out what happened. Now, this issue made it seem like the Guardians handed over the Green Lantern Corps to the United Planets. I thought the Guardians got killed off or something.
No, they got killed off at the end of John's run, but they came back. I do think that's what happened, Drew. We just weren't reading. So it wasn't very good.
But anyway, so the Guardians are out there something, probably doing their Guardian thing, and I'm guessing they're going to come back at some point. But right now we have the United Planets that are in charge of the Green Lanterns. And I like how you said they were kind of like Jedi. And we know how Hal feels about Sinestro, so it wasn't surprising at all that he blew up there during the meeting. And we know Theros is kind of... actually, he kind of reminds me of the Emperor because we've seen his evil side.
Yeah.
So I am loving this series.
It's unclear to me whether he's evil or just corrupt, right? Like, just very content with the power that he has. That's going to be interesting to see, Drew, whether he's like, not to say not bad, like, I think he's bad, but I'm curious whether he's evil or just, extremely corrupted by the power of his station. I am very intrigued by his character and can't wait to get more out of that. The other thing that I really thought was interesting in this one, Drew, was the attack on him. Of course, Hal believes that Sinestro is behind it, and why wouldn't he? It's Yellow Lanterns attacking on Sinestro's homeworld, and that's absolutely something Sinestro would do. But it kind of seemed like Sinestro was not in on that attack, and that was really interesting. It seemed like Sinestro actually legitimately was not part of that plan.
And if he wasn't, who was?
Yeah.
Because, Sinestro, if he wasn't behind that, he's going to be investigating himself. And that could be interesting too, but somehow
could explain some of his desperation to get back to his homeworld.
Yes, because maybe somebody displaced Sinestro, and that's how we ended up on Earth.
So we know that he's on Earth, at least according to the first few issues, according to Sinestro himself, he's on Earth because he got caught up in Pariah's scheme in Dark Crisis. And obviously he's extremely, obsessed with control, especially over his home world. And because his home world was blown up once upon a time at the end of Johns' run. So it makes sense, you know, that he'd want to get back just in regards to his own desire for order and control. But it would make even more sense if he knows he needs to get back because something was rotten in his home world from his viewpoint that he needed to root out. And at the worst possible time, he gets caught up in whatever the hell Pariah was doing, right? And now he can't get back. And, when he knows he needs to, that desperation starts to make more sense.
Yeah, this was a really good issue, and I'm glad we got to see the flashback on that. And now we've learned that the blue power battery is blown up, so that's interesting too, because we know something's going on with the emotional spectrum.
I love that we're involving the more of the spectrum again. Like, it feels like we're going back to the most successful run of Green Lantern of all time. Like, I feel like whether you liked the stories or not, obviously we both did, is one thing, but it's inarguable from a popularity standpoint that Green Lantern was ever bigger than it was during the Johns run, and it feels like we're back in that era, and it is just thrilling. It is so well written. The artwork is right there with it. Oh my gosh, Drew, I'm loving this book so much.
I am too. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week, Titans Beast World number 4. Middle Hampton. Peacemaker shoots a tiger and a frog that is chasing Chester Runk. Chester states that Peacemaker just killed his son. Chester opens his chest to reveal a black hole, but Peacemaker shoots him in the neck with a knockout dart first. Ivytown. Gigantus grows big and then is attacked by spores, transforming her into a giant grizzly bear. Oracle calls for help and the Titans respond. Swamp Thing reinforces buildings that are crumbling. Superman, John Kent, and Starfire fly the grizzly bear into the air. Cyborg opens a boom tube, teleporting Giganta 5 miles away. Spores exit Giganta and head straight for Superman, John Kent. John uses his Superman blue powers to fry the spores and they fall harmlessly to the ground dead. The Bureau of Sovereignty takes to the airwaves, stating that they have been given the power to act in the interest of humanity. If the Titans are unwilling to do what must be done, then they will. Raven was on her way to protect Beast Boy when Dr. Hate appears and attacks her. Deep beneath Stryker's Island prison, outside of Metropolis, Amanda Waller orders Lex Luthor to use his Justice League teleporter tech to teleport Chester Runk inside of Garro. A black hole opens up inside of Garro, killing both Chester and Beast Boy together. To be continued. Now, before you say anything about this issue, Cletus, I gotta say, this story just feels like it's just gone off the rails.
I agree, but my bigger question, Drew, is, are we in the right order? I feel like the one we read last week had to have happened after this, right? Or Nightwing gets infected in the last part of the story that we read, and he's not in. I'm lost.
You're right. Nightwing did get infected, didn't he?
I know that was technically in the Titans book, correct?
Yes, not that was in the Titans book.
So I'm hoping that will make some sense, and that whatever's supposed to happen there is going to tie back in to the main story, Drew. But as it remember, DC wants you to be reading all of these, and they want you to be reading them as they come out. And we read them, again, we're not on the week that they're coming out, but we're reading them, together with the books that came out in the same week. So that book came out first, the Titans book, and then this book came out. How could you possibly read those two comics back to back and have any idea what's going on? They're written by the same guy.
Yes, they are.
Wrote both of those.
Yes, they are. I honestly think that we have an issue with DC's editorial not keeping track of stuff, because not only have we seen it in the Titans book, we saw it with the Justice Society and Alan Scott Green Lantern book.
I mean, yeah, I agree completely with you, Drew, where they're just publishing books because they're done, but they don't necessarily make sense chronologically to be coming out when they are. Now, I want to be clear. I think when the Titans arc of this is done and when the main Beast story is done, that they will make sense. Like, I don't think that Tom Taylor just forgot that he infected Nightwing. I know that he knows that, right? But because of the way that they're being published right now, it feels like something happened and then didn't really happen. And that either way, Drew, in this story, Nightwing sees Gar die, and then in the Titans book, Gar has to be dead, and there's no one's reacting to that. And then he gets, or he got infected and gets uninfected, and then we see him in this story here. Again, I think it will make sense at some point, but that's very, very frustrating as a reader.
Yes, unless it happened in one of the side books we're not reading.
Even then, though, there's no acknowledgement that, you know what I mean, like that anything like that happened, that there's no acknowledgement of Garth. You know, something has to have happened with him. I'm assuming, Drew, that this book is taking place after the end of whatever Titans is doing. I have to assume. You know, so there's no acknowledgement of whatever went on with Starfire's fellow Tamaranian, whatever's going on there. There seems to be no acknowledgement that those things are going on, you know, at the same time. And it's the same writer. That's what doesn't make sense.
I agree with you. We probably won't get the answer to that until we read the next Titans issue.
Yeah. The other thing I mentioned this last time, Drew, is I don't agree with Tom Taylor's vision and understanding of Amanda Waller. I just fundamentally disagree with him. And it's okay. I'm not saying that I'm right. I am right. But it feels to me like Taylor's version of Waller just wants to murder the entire Justice League. Because she can't control them, she just wants them all dead. And I've never felt that way. I felt like Waller was always prepared to kill them if she needed to, but pragmatically understood the benefit of them being around. And his version of Waller seems to be, has a lot more bloodlust, Drew. And I just don't agree with that reading of the character.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Because we see it that he portrays her very similarly in his Dark Knights of Steel book also. So he whatever his vision of Waller is what it is. And he's certainly entitled to that viewpoint. I'm not saying that she's a paragon of virtue by any means. But to me, she's always felt much more pragmatic, right? That she's willing to do something bad if she feels it serves the greater good, especially her version of the greater good. But she's also willing to work with good guys and heroes of some time. I think the animated version of Waller is a great take on that, right? Frequently antagonistic, not a particularly likable person, but ultimately wants good for the world. Doesn't just like, well, I don't particularly care for the Titans being in control, so I'm gonna murder Beast Boy. I'm gonna put a bomb in his head and implode it. What? Like, that's not, come on.
Totally agree with you. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk Sweet Tooth.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
All right, monkeying around, start talking.
Mr. Bobalina.
About your podcast.
We talk about an Emmy-winning comedy series.
We talk about a band who outsold Beatles and the Stones in 1967.
Still sticking to that story, huh? Well, if you know what's good for you, you'll change your tune.
We talk about a groundbreaking multimedia project
that inspired generations of artists and fans.
All right, throw the book at them.
This book is overdue.
Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
And we're back. Let's talk Sweet Tooth, Season 2, Episode 7, I'll Find You. Jeppard is driving the bus away from the zoo when they come across debris in the road. The animal army shows up, led by Bear, who vows to protect the hybrids. A tank comes along and blows up the debris in the middle of the road. It is Bobby, who states he is back. Tiger promises Bear that the animal army will finish off the last men. In the past, Fort Smith is being invaded by the government when a contagion is loosened on the world. Birdie is able to smuggle Gus out with his pubba. Birdie is captured and taken captive. Bear tells Gus that she talked to Birdie. Bear gives Gus the cassette that Birdie recorded for him. Jeopard tells Gus that he needs a cassette player to listen to it. When they make a pit stop, Amy reveals to Jeopard that she has the sickness. She just wants to spend one last road trip with the kids and get them to safety. The hybrids cheer when they make it to Yellowstone and find the house that Gus once lived in. Bear works with the kids to gather water and firewood. Gus and Jeopard find a tape player in the house. Gus learns from the tape that his mom never came to find him because it was too dangerous for Gus. Instead, she went in search of a cure for the sickness. Bear is talking to Tiger when General Abbott gets the drop on the animal army. He overhears the directions to find the hybrids. Jeopard wakes up in the middle of the night and thinks Gus has left again. Instead, Jeopard finds Gus sitting out near the fence line thinking. They talk for a bit and then notice the northern lights. Suddenly, they hear a motorcycle nearing the compound. It is Tiger, who has obviously been wounded. She tells them that General Abbott is coming. I really enjoyed this episode, Cletus, because it was a really feel-good episode for the most part. We got to see the hybrids have a win. They made their way to Yellowstone. I just really liked this episode a lot. And then we get to the ending where we find out that General Abbott learns where they're at, which didn't surprise me at all. But I thought it was nice to have this nice episode until we get to the end of it, where we're going into the final episode.
Yeah, I liked this episode too, Drew. I loved finally getting a lot more detail on what caused the pandemic in the first place, getting more from not his real mom, but so to speak, Gus's mom. That was great. Getting that background info was a long time coming and was a very satisfying payoff for those. The hubris of her boss in injecting herself because she, like, the only way innovation can happen is if I, like, break all of these, you know, scientific standards that everybody is warning me not to do, and it causes the near extinction of mankind. That was great. Well, not great, but you know what I mean. a great story moment. The other thing, Drew, that I liked that happened, in a sense, from a writing perspective, is Abbott catching the animal army out, because it didn't really make sense. Like, the whole episode, they're like, yeah, the animal army has them surrounded and they're going to finish General Abbott. And I was like, how, though? That doesn't really make sense. It's an actual militant group. It's not like the last men are just a bunch of angry men, right, that are all getting together in a club. Like, it is an army, as we saw a whole training sequence with them. So that plot point felt silly all episode to me. I was like, I don't understand what we're doing here. Why are we pretending like kids are just gonna help, like, hold this whole army helpless because for reasons? So it was, in that sense, Drew, it was nice to see that in fact was not the case, because of course that shouldn't be the case. Why? That makes no sense. I liked that. The one thing, Drew, that I do want to mention for you chip in here, is that all season, I think I've maybe mentioned this, the tonal shifts of the show from when the kids are like the main thing that's going on screen feels very young adult, like skewing on the younger end, like very, very young adult, bordering on childish. I don't mean that in like a negative way necessarily, just that's the tone, right? That like the acting is a little, I know it's kids acting, but like the music, the tone, everything is very lighthearted, very like kids going on an adventure. And then you'll get this coin flip, and you have Big Man finding his dead wife in a bag. And that tonal flip has been so extreme this season. I felt like there was a pretty consistent tone in the first season, and this one feels like it is going back and forth strongly depending on who the main characters of the scene are. Because if it's the animals, I feel like I'm getting close to a kid's show in tone. And then if it's the adults on screen, we're getting the same very dark post-apocalyptic story. And I'm not saying it can't be both. It can. I felt like the season one, Drew, found that middle ground between the two, where you had moments of genuine horror, but also moments of levity. And this season has also done that, but it's been like on opposite ends of the spectrum, where it's either like ridiculously lighthearted or way, way dark.
Yeah, I see your point on that. I don't know. I really enjoyed this episode because, you know, we got to see the hybrids and the adults kind of bond as a family. And I guess I just really enjoyed that. I felt like we got a break from all the trouble that's been going on. And then now we're going to have to, they're going to be scrambling to survive. I mean, they're with General Abbott's army coming, they're going to be in real trouble. I honestly don't know how they're going to get out of it. So it'll be interesting to see. And I have a feeling the end of next episode is not going to be a happy ending.
Yeah, I agree. I don't expect a very happy ending here. I do feel, I guess I should say, I don't feel, I'm very curious to find out whether Abbott will continue as the villain or whether he's going to meet his end this season, Drew, and we'll have a different antagonist. Because there's a door there for the woman that he came to an agreement with on their sort of utopia project. There's a door there for her to take over as the antagonist for the and also just the disease in general to be a sort of faceless antagonist in the final season. And I'm kind of curious, again, as someone who's not read the comic, I don't really know. And I also have no idea how closely we're following the comic either. So I don't know, Drew. I really don't know if General Abbott is going to be taken down or if we're going to see him defeated, but still around and still around to be the antagonist of the final season.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to find out.
I like not knowing. That's very exciting.
Yes, it is. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah, so we touched on it briefly, but I was very curious. Because I knew that the Jay Garrick comic has not been making the Professor Hughes character up to read into it a little more. And his first appearance, as you would imagine, came in Flash Comics number 1, which came out in 1940. And like the comic that we read this week says, he is working with Jay on heavy water experiments when in the original comic, it is an actual accident and it causes Jay to get his powers. And Hughes is completely fully good. There's no really question mark or anything there. He's just completely on Jay's side, and we're getting a very, very, very different version of that character now. So if anybody is curious to see the original take, much more, you know, one kind of one layer to that character, Flash Comics number 1, the origin of Jay Garrick.
All right, and for my shout out, I went to a concert this past week. Mia X Alley. One of them plays, Mia plays the electric violin, and Allie plays the bagpipes. And it was cool. They played Game of Thrones. They played the theme song to Power Rangers. They played The Devil Went Down to Georgia. They played Freebird. It was just fun to see the electric violin and the bagpipes together. And it was awesome. I came across them on TikTok and had seen some videos of them online. And then when I found out they were going to be here in India, I had to go check them out. It was an awesome concert. Apparently, they were here last year, too. So I didn't know about them until I came across them on TikTok. So it was fun. It was different. So hopefully, they're back next year. I'm going to go see them again. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And we had NBA All-Star Weekend was here in Indiana this year. So that was really great for the city, too.
Oh, yeah.
Good stuff going on here.
Okay. Calista, that brings up another story. Calista and I were Calista and I were trying to go to a restaurant downtown. It was on the other side of the circle. I made reservations for 5:30, and we were still stuck in traffic at 5:50, I think. I could not get to the other side of the circle. Traffic was backed up because of the NBA thing. So I ended up turning and going around. We ended up eating at the Rathskeller. I had been there before, but Calista never had. So, and it was right across the street from the venue. But yeah, we had our troubles with the NBA thing. The traffic was just backed up. They had the circle blocked off, and I couldn't get around. And so we ended up eating at a different restaurant. We still had a good time, though. And the Rathskeller's, it's a good restaurant. It's an old German restaurant. So, all right. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, text us, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Catwoman, Green Lantern War Journal, Nightwing, Superman, Titans, Wonder Woman, and of course, the season finale of Sweet Tooth. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move up.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.